Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Giabili reporting. The European Union has accused Turkey of backsliding on democracy and urged Ankara to conduct a structured and more frequent political dialogue on key issues. Members of the European Parliament approved the annual report on Turkey Thursday. The report criticized the country's record on human rights and media freedom last year and urged the country to show progress on rule of law and fundamental values. Ankara immediately rejected the report. 2 years after Boko Haram insurgents kidnapped hundreds of schoolgirls from the Nigerian town of Chibok, a video has emerged purporting to show 15 of them alive and well. VOA's Chris Stein reports from Lagos, Nigeria.
The camera pans shakily over the girls' faces as they recite their names and where they were abducted from. The video, which was obtained by CNN, is the first time any of the 219 abducted girls have been seen publicly since Boko Haram released a propaganda video featuring a group of them shortly after their capture in 2014. As residents of the town gathered at the ruins of the school to mark the two-year anniversary, Chibok elder Ayuba Alamson said many had taken heart in the girls' appearance in the video. Others were wary. Philip Yama, whose sister Margaret Yama was abducted, says he's heard too many rumors about the girl since the abduction to take the video at face value.
I can't believe it until I saw this girl with my own eyes.
Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
A 6.2 magnitude earthquake struck southern Japan late Thursday, knocking over at least 19 houses. A U.S. Geological Survey said the initial quake was followed by several others in the Kumamoto Prefecture on Japan's Kyushu Island. Japanese broadcasters report at least 15 people being taken to hospitals. This is VOA News. World Bank President Jim Yong Kim said Thursday he is extremely concerned about the widespread creation of offshore companies by wealthy people around the world to evade taxes. Kim explained it takes large sums away from governments that need the money to fight poverty. Kim told a press conference in Washington he is distressed by the scope of the offshore accounts as disclosed in the Panama Papers. The recent report by investigative journalists is based on a massive leak of documents from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca that for decades has helped create such companies around the globe. Kim called for a more transparent tax system around the globe. A UN Children's Fund study has found a widening gap between poor and richer children in the world's wealthiest countries. As Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, the UNICEF report analyzes the consequences of this growing inequality.
UNICEF These patrols will continue to help build.
The U.S. military has been conducting joint patrols in the South China Sea with the Philippines. Speaking at a news conference in Manila with his Filipino counterpart, U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter said the first South China Sea joint patrol was carried out in March. Defense officials say the second joint patrol was completed in early April. For the first time in 16 years, a South Korean ruling party has failed to win a majority in a legislative election. The surprise losses suffered by President Park Geun-hye's Saenuri Party Wednesday revealed widespread public discontent. With her conservative economic policies and hardline approach to North Korea's nuclear threat. Her party won 122 out of 300 seats in the South Korean National Assembly. And the main opposition Minju Party of Korea won one more, garnering 123 seats. The Minju Party promised to focus on job creation, increasing the minimum wage, and building more affordable housing. China is blasting the human rights record bin, the United States, in its annual tit-for-tat report, saying money and family connections are corrupting politics and calling U.S. airstrike in Syria and Iraq a gross violation of other countries' human rights. The report issued by the Cabinet State Council Information Office also cited gun crime and excessive use of force by police and touched on other topics including corruption in the prison system, homelessness, racial conflict, and gender pay disparity. The report said, since the U.S. government can't be bothered to raise a mirror to look at itself, it's up to others to complete the task. I am Giabili in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-Africa news and world development. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
2 years after Boko Haram insurgents kidnapped hundreds of schoolgirls from the Nigerian town of Chibok, a video has emerged purporting to show 15 of them alive and well. It's the first sighting of the missing girls in nearly 2 years.
That's Chris Stein reporting from Lagos. Details next.
Also, three European envoys have arrived in Libya to show support for the new but struggling unity government. And former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo talks about agriculture's potential for growth in Africa.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, 2 years after Boko Haram insurgents kidnapped hundreds of schoolgirls from the Nigerian town of Chibok, a video has emerged purporting to show 15 of them alive and well. It's the first sighting of the missing girls in nearly 2 years. VOA's Chris Stein tells us more.
The camera pans shakily over the girls' faces as they recite their names and where they were abducted from. The video, which was obtained by CNN, is the first time any of the 219 abducted girls have been seen publicly since Boko Haram released a propaganda video featuring a group of them shortly after their capture in 2014. The kidnappings from the government secondary school in Chibok drew global protests. Allies, including the United States, offered to help Nigeria find them. So far, they've turned up nothing. Yana Galang is the mother of one of the abducted girls who has seen the video.
Yes, they are all girls.
Her daughter, Rifkatu Dalam, was not among the girls in the video, Galang said. She declined to comment further. Minister of Information and Culture Lai Mohammed said he questions the authenticity of the video. In the video, one girl claims to be speaking on December 25th of last year. Mohammed said he found that hard to believe, since many of the girls hadn't changed in appearance during their months in captivity. He also said the government has received numerous false leads about the girls' whereabouts, including a similar video they obtained last July. The video isn't the only evidence that the girls are still alive. Yakubu Nkeke, chairman of the abducted Chibok girls' parents' movement for rescue, says parents of two of the girls have recently received phone calls from their daughters' cell phone numbers. But when they called back, the voice on the other end was an unidentified man who told the parents the phone belonged to his wife. As residents of the town gathered at the ruins of the school to mark the two-year anniversary, Chibok elder Ayuba Alamson said many had taken heart in the girls' appearance in the video.
People have been offering prayers right yesterday and today to see that we see these girls alive.
Others were wary. Philip Yama, whose sister Margaret Yama was abducted, says he's heard too many rumors about the girls since the abduction to take the video at face value.
I can't believe it until I saw these girls with my own eyes.
In the 2 years since the abduction, Chibok has changed, in many ways for the worse. The government has demolished the town's school, and despite promises to replace it, has not built a new one. 18 parents of kidnapped girls have since passed away, Nkeke said. They lost their lives to Boko Haram, or ailments related to the stress of waiting for the return of their missing daughters. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Lawyers for the detained leader of a Shiite group in Nigeria say Ibrahim Zakzaki is now partially paralyzed. He was arrested last December after his followers clashed with army troops, reportedly leaving 350 people dead. The military says only 7 people died in the violence. The army had accused members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria of trying to assassinate the army chief of staff who was riding in a convoy. The French news agency quotes lawyers for Zakzaki as saying their client now walks with a limp and is blind in one eye. The Shiite leader has gone to court to challenge his detention and is seeking $10 million in damages. Northern Nigeria is predominantly Sunni Muslim.
Three European envoys have arrived in Libya to show support for the new but struggling unity government. AFP reports ambassadors from Britain, France, and Spain are in Tripoli. It's the first such visit by European diplomats since EU countries closed their embassies in mid-2014 amid violence and fighting. The government of national accord is waiting for formal approval from two rival governments that have been operating in Libya, one in Tripoli and the other in Tobruk. One of the problems the unity government will face is the presence of Islamic State fighters in the country. Estimates of their numbers range from 3,000 to 6,000. It's reported the militants are in firm control of the city of Sirte. One official calls it a lost city where executions take place on a daily basis.
With ongoing violence by militant groups such as Islamic State, Boko Haram, and Al-Shabaab, experts are calling for a multi-pronged approach to counter the security threat. General William Ward is the former commander of AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command. Senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke to General Ward about the seriousness of Islamic State expansion in Libya and its connections to Boko Haram.
The situation in Libya presents a serious problem for all of us, because of the lack of an effective government in Libya at the current time and the plethora of weapons as a result of the Gaddafi regime that were made available to these groups, that presents a very serious problem to the region, as well as because of the global threat that it poses to all of us. And so that situation is something that we all need to be concerned about and be paying particular attention to with respect to the movement of foreign fighters in and out of Libya, the movement of weapons out of Libya that would be used in other places in the region, but also around the world.
And there are signs that ISIS in Libya is getting some sort of allegiances from other terrorist organizations in Africa like Boko Haram. How would such connection increase the security threats in the region?
I believe any time these criminal terrorist groups come together and collaborate, it increases the collective threat that they pose. And so as you have proclamations by Boko Haram of an alliance with ISIS, I believe that is something that we all should be concerned about because it does heighten the threat that they pose as they share ideas, as they share varying other methods that would be used to inflict terror in the region, but also around the world.
But so far, most of the effort is focused on counter-terrorism measures security-wise. What's your vision for a comprehensive strategy to counter the rising tide of terrorism in Africa?
Countering terrorism is more than just a single-pronged approach that's required. Countering terrorism has with it the notion that it has to be attacked from multiple areas, multiple arenas. Clearly, the security approach is an important one, it's a critical one. Those who would do harm to innocent people have to be removed. And to do that requires security forces, it requires security apparatuses, it requires effective intelligence collection apparatus that can determine where they are, where they operate, prevent them from having the support that they require in order to continue to operate. And so you have to do things to limit, to restrict, to deny their ability to conduct their actions. But in addition to that, those conditions that exist that would spawn areas or locations that would be favorable to terrorist activities, that also has to be addressed. And in that regard, there are other activities that must be conducted to address the threat of terrorism that may not be security measures, but maybe things that impact security, shortages of food, other economic activities, health concerns, educational concerns, infrastructure concerns, things that normal everyday people, wherever they may live, have a concern about having those things also being addressed to make those areas less conducive to accepting terrorists in their midst.
But to create this horizon of hope you talked about, what role do you envision for the U.S. and the international community in terms of improving economic situation, achieving better governance in countries that are witnessing a rise in violent extremism?
That's a great question, and it's exactly because of the partnership that you have to create. And again, it's not the complete role of the country that would offer and contribute some resources. The receiving country has responsibility there as well. From transparency, whatever resources are received, transparency in their use, transparency in their application such that the impacted populations receive the benefit of that, but also so that it's not just a handout. It's something that will help create an environment where people are in a better position to do for themselves as well. And I believe the role that the United States has, the role that the European community has, the role that the global community has in all of that is there. Doing it in conjunction with individual nations, but also doing it in conjunction with the regional alliances that are important. You do things regionally as well as with individual nations because of the ability of terrorists to transcend these porous borders. So if you aren't doing things regionally and cooperating from your intelligence, from your infrastructure development, those things are also important to address the whole notion of creating this horizon of hope for peoples where they live.
General William Ward is the former commander of AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
So far this year, nearly 174,000 migrants and refugees have arrived in Europe. Most have come from Turkey across the Aegean Sea to Greece. But that route is essentially closed following a deal last month between Turkey and the European Union. Now the route from North Africa to Italy is getting busy again as the weather on the Mediterranean improves. Nearly 20,000 migrants have made the journey to Italy so far this year, but many more are expected. The military advisor to the UN Special Envoy to Libya says there are 1 million migrants in Libya. General Paolo Serra says at the current pace, some 250,000 could arrive in Italy by the end of the year. That's 100,000 more than last year. More than 2,000 were rescued this week off the coast of Libya. The UNHCR says so far this year, more than 700 migrants and refugees have died during sea journeys to Europe.
In an unusual development, people from war-torn Yemen are fleeing to a region where citizens have been scattered the world over by decades of conflict. In the past year, nearly half of the 176,000 people who have fled Yemen's conflict have gone to the Horn of Africa, according to the UN Refugee Agency. Many are Africans returning to their countries of origin, but about 26,000 are Yemenis with nowhere else to turn to. Jill Craig reports from Hargeisa in Somaliland.
Wasim Saeed Mohammed arrived in Somaliland in February with his wife and two sons. They fled Yemen after Houthi militants attacked their home in Aden. He says, "This is the only country where the cost of living is cheap and there is good security and I can live with the people." Mohammed works at a bakery owned by his uncle's Syrian friend, Abdul Raham Darwish. Darwish had been living in Yemen since the 1980s, but brought his family to Hargeisa last year. "The situation here is very good," he says, "but I'm lacking some materials and support. I want to leave and go to another country, but it's very difficult. I cannot take that risk at sea with my wife and two daughters," he added. "If I can get some legal way to Europe or elsewhere, I'd be willing to do that." Options for Yemeni refugees are limited. Most don't have the money to pay smugglers or attempt the long, dangerous route to Europe, which involves crossing the Gulf of Aden, then going by land through Egypt to the Mediterranean. And even then, many can't get visas in Europe or even Turkey. Somaliland may be safe and welcoming, but it is poor. Unemployment is high. The UNHCR says that of the 10,000 people who have arrived here from Yemen, about 1,900 are Yemeni nationals. There is no refugee camp in Somaliland. The government says it is open to the idea, but the UN says the numbers don't justify it. Somaliland broke away from Somalia in 1991 after a three-year war, so many of the people here know the refugee experience firsthand. Still, resources are limited, says Somaliland's resettlement minister, Ali Syed Regel. He says the refugees are in the same situation as Somalilanders because the Somalilanders also don't have enough jobs. So anyone who had skills working in Yemen, he can do the same here. But we are trying to help them. Upon arrival, refugees are given food, medical care, and cash, about $100 per person by the UN. They can also get transport within Somalia if they wish, but it's not enough for some, like Jihan Ali Abdullah.
I want to leave. I want to leave this country. I want to go to a civilized country. I want to live. I want to be stable financially. I want to be stable in my life. I want to go back to school. Do something. Make a life. Here's not life. There's no life here.
For now, they must make the best of things in Somaliland. Jill Craig, VOA News, Hargeisa.
Coming up on 21 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, Africa's smallholder farmers will be honored at the new Africa Food Prize 2016 awards that will take place in September in Nairobi, Kenya. They will highlight significant contributions to agriculture, Africa's largest source of income and biggest opportunity for eliminating poverty and enhancing prosperity. The contributions of smallholder farmers will be recognized this year with the new Africa Food Prize. The award is sponsored by the Norway-based chemical and fertilizer company Yara International ASA and AGRA, the alliance led by Africans with roots in farming communities across the continent. The winners are selected by a panel of independent and distinguished leaders and chaired by former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo. He says agriculture is the key to Africa's future.
If we are going to get it right, agriculture must be the centerpiece of our economic development, economic growth, economic activity for a number of reasons. One, that is where we get our food from. Two, it is only agribusiness, talking from the equipment for land preparation and up to the food on the table, the whole value chain that can really provide enough jobs for young population.
Obasanjo explains that agriculture creates many commodities and products. This makes food production a renewable sector compared to what he calls the vanishing influence of oil and minerals.
Agriculture can be the beginning of our industrialization by value addition. If you turn cocoa bean into cocoa butter and cocoa powder, you are industrializing. Make chocolate out of your cocoa bean and out of your cocoa butter and cocoa powder, you are further industrializing. If you turn your maize or your cassava to starch, you are industrializing. If you turn the starch to glucose or fructose, you are further industrializing.
Obasanjo emphasizes that products made from food crops earn foreign exchange and are key to generating wealth and alleviating poverty.
The reason why we should encourage, we should inspire, and we should reward and celebrate those who make significant contribution to agricultural development, to agribusiness, to agricultural production, to agricultural transformation in Africa. And that is what this prize is all about.
The former Nigerian president says all participants in the agricultural sector will be considered for awards, including farmers, financiers, innovators, manufacturers, and marketers. In addition, by showcasing the achievements and innovations, it is hoped that the attention will draw young people into food production. However, he stresses the basic needs of young families must be met if they are to succeed.
We must make agriculture attractive. Attractive in the sense that what do they want in the city? They want to make sure that they get a job. They like to have the bright light of the city. Now, if you cannot give them bright light in the rural area, you must be able to give them light, at least light to light their rooms and light their house. And they must have schools for their children. They must have potable water. They must have roads that will take their product from their farm to the market.
He says young people also need to learn about microfinancing, marketing, and food processing. They also need encouragement.
And part of the encouragement is what this Africa Food Prize is all about. to show that, yes, you reward, you celebrate, you inspire those who have done it, and you inspire others to follow suit. Now, we must also provide role models and those who will mentor young people who want to go into agriculture.
In addition, Mr. Obasanjo acknowledges that not enough focus has been placed on women, who make up the majority of farmers in Africa. He says they should be in the forefront of decision-making and formulating policies. Obasanjo says leaving women out of economic growth, whether it is agriculture or manufacturing, means excluding half of Africa's population needed to boost development. So if you know of someone who should be recognized for his or her outstanding work in agriculture, submit your nomination now to AfricaFoodPrize.org. That's AfricaFoodPrize.org. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Opposition politicians in Chad claim there was fraud during Sunday's presidential election, but African Union observers say the poll, while flawed, was fair. Moki Edwin Kenzeka has more from N'Djamena.
African Union observers of Chad's presidential election say despite irregularities, overall Sunday's vote was peaceful and credible. Former Malian president and head of the AU observer mission to Chad, Dion Kunda Traore, said issues included the late opening of polling stations in hard-to-access areas and poorly trained polling officers.
Nous n'avons pas d'appréhension particulière par rapport à ce qui va se passer après.
He says they don't know what will happen after the proclamation of the results, but the AU is urging all candidates and their followers to accept the verdict. He says those who are not satisfied with the results should contest them in the courts. Kamalo Salifu Turabi leads the Pan-African Institute for Election Assistance Observer Mission.
Nous avons évalué les indicateurs possibles qui nous permettent d'estimer le taux de participation.
He says despite irregularities, voter participation is estimated at 85%. The opposition says there was fraud, including ballot stuffing. Chadian President Idriss Deby is widely expected to win a fifth term in office. The country faces continued threats from the Nigerian terror group Boko Haram. Social issues like the high cost of living sparked unprecedented protests in the run-up to the poll. Five rights activists have been in jail for the last 3 weeks. Chad has cracked down on the media, in particular the foreign press, since the vote. The French broadcaster TV5 Monde says its crew was forbidden from filming. Mohamed Abdoulaye Issa, Chad's official in charge of press accreditation, says journalists were not authorized to report as the country waits for results.
Après l'élection du 10, certains organes de presse à travers des reporters voudraient rester sur place attendre.
He says journalists wishing to report on non-election related issues must apply for new accreditation to remain in Chad. He says that does not infringe on press freedom. The Electoral Commission has 2 weeks from the April 10 vote to declare results. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, N'Djamena.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
voaafrica.com.
On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.